All right, so I managed to corral down Corbin Haycock here. First of all, Corbin, thanks so much for joining Twitter finally.
Yeah, you broke me down.
Because I think you've got lots to contribute, and I think Corbin is an ED doc extraordinaire who specializes in making the upstairs care look banal as opposed to what he's actually doing in the downstairs. So really happy to be able to discuss this with you, Corbin. And you're from California, right?
Right, yeah. In Southern California.
In Loma Linda, I think?
Loma Linda is my part-time job. I also work part-time out in Palm Springs. But my main place is a county hospital for Riverside County, where I work full-time there. And it's affiliated with the Loma Linda residency.
And this is a county hospital where they put swans in the ED. That's just incredible.
It's similar. It's not quite a swan. It's a transpulmonary thermodilution catheter. So you can't get wedge pressures or anything on that, but you can do some cool stuff that a swan can't do.
That's awesome. All right, so we're going to chat about the Andromeda shock trial recently published in JAMA. A lot of buzz about it in the last few days, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What are your thoughts?
My thoughts about the, first of all, I woke up, yesterday and you had texted me about, with the little video of the never-ending circle to destroy volume responsiveness.
Yeah.
And, that's kind of this thing that I always have kind of get bothered about. And at first I didn't realize that you're referring to the Andromeda trial. But once I figured it out, I was, thinking about, this whole idea about lactate and using it as a resuscitative, indicator of how you're doing. I hear this all the time about, oh, the lactate's up, so I'm going to give fluids. And, why people think that is. And I made a comment yesterday on your blog post about this with Rory. And I think the problem lies in the idea that lactate necessarily means there's tissue hypoxia going on.
Yeah.
Which is maybe not true, and I think probably not true. And, my kind of take on that is it means you're sick if your lactate is up, and it's up because there's a lot of catecholamines, driving aerobic lactate production, which I assume most people who are listening to this understand. But I think by and large, this is something that your average doc, especially maybe an ER doctor, has no idea about you can have a non-anaerobic production of lactate.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to just for the junior listeners or the people who don't do resuscitation or haven't been sort of actively following resuscitation literature for the last decade or so. That is a common, and I came out of residency believing that, feeling that, that was deeply ingrained in me, that, an elevated lactate is due to high anaerobic metabolism due to tissue hypoxia. And that's been debunked, like you just said. And that, although that may be true to some degree in some cases, the largest part is just due to metabolic rerouting and resulting in lactate. And I think the other thing that people need to remember is that lactate in and of itself is a cellular fuel and is entirely non-toxic. It's a powerful signal for a strong sympathetic activation and injury and inflammation, but in and of itself, there's nothing, bad about lactate itself. And you can't feel that an elevated lactate is a means that you've got tissue hypoxia, and secondarily that you can try to fix by increasing cardiac output.
Yeah, I've actually even heard, people argue that clearing the lactate might actually be a bad thing because, lactate is such a, what the heart, loves to oxidize the lactate. It's a better fuel than the glucose under stressful situations.
Yep.
And, there's some studies out there with like sodium lactate infusions and cardiogenic shock in pigs that show that they survive more when you do that. And also some animal studies with sepsis that show sodium lactate infusions actually help. Back to the idea of using it as a resuscitative tool and a endpoint with lactate clearance to show you're going the right way. If you believe this idea that lactate equals tissue hypoxia, then it follows that you need to increase the cardiac output to fix that. That would be a logical conclusion. But the problem with that is that if your basis for making that decision is wrong in the first place, mm-hmm. then the action is incorrect as well.
Yep.
If we look at the hemodynamic profile of most patients with a sepsis syndrome, you know what they have is an elevated cardiac output, yep. and they have a decreased systemic vascular resistance, and the CVP, which is not really a volume status but is sort of related, is decreased because the cardiac output's so high. It's just running all the venous return through to the arterial circuit. So the problem isn't with a cardiac output or a delivery of oxygen in sepsis. It's something else is going on, and so if we're sitting here trying to fix the problem of sepsis and we're attacking it from a standpoint of increasing the cardiac output, well, the cardiac output's already elevated.
Yep, absolutely. I know, a while back they used to commonly talk about warm shock and cold shock, and I think it's important to realize that, sepsis can evolve. It can evolve from warm shock into cold shock as you sometimes get, significant cardiomyopathy, septic cardiomyopathy. But by and large, your first presenters usually tend to be in that, warm shock, and there's a fairly simple test for that, even before you start putting anything on, is just touching the patient.
Yep, absolutely. That's true. I mean, you do run into patients with a depressed cardiac function, and sometimes it's diastolic, which is worse than the systolic dysfunction. But to iron that out, I mean, you can't put your hands on them, or both of us would probably be using POCUS to do that. But if you keep on chasing this volume responsiveness, sooner or later you're gonna just cause complete congestion of the circuit number one. So you're gonna get dings to your kidneys. You're gonna get portal hypertension and gut edema, which is gonna just keep the sepsis syndrome going. The other thing is that there's some data out there that shows that over aggressive crystalloid infusions actually destroy the integrity of the capillaries and small vessels. Mm-hmm.
The glycocalyx.
Exactly. Rory had mentioned that it's a leaky state. Well, the fluids make it even more leaky. I mean, what happens is there's some interactions with just shearing forces on the glycocalyx, but things like atrial natriuretic peptide and LPS in the presence of volume overload actually causes shedding as well. So there's some biochemical stuff, going on there in the small vessels as well. The other thing is that, if sepsis is kind of a low resistance state by dilutional effect of the hemoglobin, the viscosity is going to go down and your SVR is going to go down from that as well too. So there's a lot of reasons why crystalloid is not a good strategy for resuscitation in hyperdynamic sort of distributive shock.
Yeah, those are all excellent points. And I think it also ties back into the fact that there's also data out there showing that we can't treat the circulation and sepsis like you would just a glass of water and say, well, if I give it a little too much, I can pour a little bit out and I'm okay. Because there's the as you said, all those little cascade of things that happen to do with the glycocalyx and all that. By taking off the fluid with some Lasix, you don't go back to your original state. And I think there was subgroups, and I forget if it was VISEP or VAS studies that showed that, the patients that started and got the fluid but then had it taken away, they didn't quite get to the better outcome of those people who didn't get it in the first place. So I think that's important to remember too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think that and one thing I would actually like to add about their algorithm there, and it's not in their the algorithm diagram that's there, but they do mention it somewhere in there that if they have a rise in their CVP of like 5 or something, that would be an indication to stop chasing the volume responsiveness. And, you know, that's actually, to be fair, is I think a smart thing to put in there. But to me, and I know you totally agree with this too, is I think before we start giving fluids, we need to actually check to make sure that there's some volume tolerance involved, because that should be the starting point before trying to throw fluids at something, is if we're going to harm the patient who's already got a lot of congestion going or showing signs of congestion.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's why, like, I was I gave a little talk at the STOEM conference a few weeks ago, and I said, you know, I barely care about volume responsiveness. And it's partly tongue in cheek, because I very much do, in the sense that I think it'd be absurd to give fluids if you don't have volume responsiveness. But I think that I so rarely get to that real question, you know. I get to, you know, the first thing is, do I think they need fluid? And I think that's a multi, you know, I don't think you can put that in an algorithm, or if you can, it's going to be exceedingly complex.
Right.
And then, two, are they tolerant? And only after that do I get to the, are they volume responsive? So I find that I very rarely get to the, are they volume responsive? Because for a reason or another, I mean, I do sometimes, but I think the areas in which the people who are concerned about congestion tend to operate, you know, which is going to be tend to be in the non sort of full IVCs and all that, you're almost always going to be fluid responsive.
Right.
So you barely need to ask yourself that question, which is why I never do, you know, pulse pressure variation, VTI and all that stuff. You know, I sometimes show it for just for fun, you know, or for academic interest, but I can't say that it really has much place in my clinical decision making.
Well, you know, I actually do it, but
I know.
Almost,
that's why I told you.
almost never, right? First of all, I mean, right now we're both volume responsive, right? So that doesn't mean we need a crystalloid, you know, bolus. I do actually look, but the purpose of me looking is not to trigger a response of giving fluids, but it's a data point that says, okay, fluids are kind of something I should be considering, right? And so if there's no volume responsiveness, I'm not considering fluids.
Exactly.
That's the bottom line. But if there is, then I ask myself, okay, should I be giving the fluids?
Okay.
I don't know if that makes any sense, but there's a lot of stop points on the way to giving fluids for me.
Yeah, I think it's fair to start in either direction. I mean, you can start by assessing the responsiveness and then taking it from there. Or my personal take is I do the other way around. And when I get to that question of, I think it would be okay for me to give fluids, let me check if they're responsive. So I do very much care about it, but I'll sometimes sort of play the card of, I don't think it matters that much, you know, as much as emphasis.
I think I agree with you. I think you're right about that. But this whole point of using the lactate actually just drives you to give the fluids.
I think that's
the whole problem, you know?
Yeah.
With using lactate as a resuscitative endpoint. There's going to be like a lot of lactate bashing and stuff, I'm sure, from everybody. And, you know, I think that lactate actually is very valuable. I mean, when I see a lactate that's high on a septic patient, I'm paying, you know, very close attention to them. But other things is you have to ask yourself, you know, there's kind of a broad differential to why that lactate's up. So, you know, I'm going to totally ignore it if they're getting a MedNeb or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, a significant amount of sepsis patients actually probably are thiamine deficient. And there's, you know, there's a paper I've seen out there where, you know, they gave thiamine to septic patients, and overall, it didn't seem to help, but in the subset of patients that actually were thiamine deficient, it actually, they survived more with their sepsis syndromes. So, you know, this is kind of a high risk, malnourished yeah. sort of population, elderly, alcoholic, you know, they're not usually or often completely healthy in the first place. And I think they are kind of a setup for a thiamine deficiency. And it does seem to help if that's the problem. And then, you know, there's the whole, you know, vitamin C, thiamine, corticosteroid, sure. you know,
metabolic resuscitation.
Yeah. So yeah, but you know, I've found sometimes if someone kind of looks sick and their lactate's just kind of sticking right where it is, you give them like 200 milligrams of thiamine and the lactate goes away, you know? And
interesting.
And that's, you know, kind of evidence that, hey, this guy probably was a little thiamine deficient.
Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. I'm sure that's what it is. I mean, I think that for almost all the sepsis treatments we have out there, the problem is looking for that one magic bullet to try to hit a super heterogeneous population of, you know, individuals and, you know, and bugs and sites. And I think it's a pipe dream to think that we're going to come up with one thing that fixes it all. And I think that the magic is going to be in like Lawrence Lynn has been talking about, finding mm-hmm. the true phenotypes of sepsis and then being able to apply the treatments for each. And for some, it may be someone who needs a steroid heavy approach. Some others, it may be the malnourished or less well patient may need a heavy metabolic resuscitation, et cetera. I think that's where it's going to go. But unfortunately, everyone's yeah. stuck on large RCTs with one thing fits all, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's totally true. I mean, there's a lot of questions to be answered. You know, like yesterday you mentioned even, you know, the driving pressure for perfusion, and we tend to think of it being the MAP minus the diastolic without considering that there's a resistor, on, you know, somewhere along that side of the, just, you know, between the arterioles and the capillaries.
Yeah.
And that driving pressure is actually smaller than you think it is. And there's actually, you know, some other cool stuff there that, you know, like a second vascular waterfall besides the one that happens on the venous side, but
right.
but happens there too. And that brings up all kinds of questions of, you know, the critical closing pressure of these things and how high do you have to get the blood pressure to pop, you know, open things up and all that. And, you know, I'm sure Jean-Emile would be like the guy to ask about that one, because he's, you know, the master of the physiology, but there's all kinds of stuff that we don't understand that's going on. And to put it all on a lactate, and, you know, it bothers me that it's a mandate that you must be using this from, you know, down here, down south.
Yeah.
I think it's a bit crazy, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm glad I'm north for that particular reason. And on a quick anecdote on the critical closing pressure, it was actually the first one to bring that up to me in a really clinical way was André Deneau, who was, you know, TEing every organ between the scalp and the toes intraoperatively, and was looking at renal flow during cardiac surgery, and all of a sudden, as you know, he would see that the blood pressure would come down, and in a few cases, all of a sudden, boom, no more renal arterial perfusion.
Yeah. I'd seen that paper. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And then he would crank up the blood pressure, and it wouldn't restart until he actually got higher to the sort of that closing point that had initially occurred. Nothing would happen. And then all of a sudden, boom, restored perfusion. Whereas we tend to think about it as just sort of a gradual process, something like that. But no, there's systems in there that are, for whatever reason, said, okay, we're shutting this off, you know, and then, okay, now we've got enough to open up again. It's interesting how to intervene on it, essentially difficult, but interesting stuff.
Yep. It's almost like a recruitment maneuver, right? For the, for the capillary bits to pop them open with a higher blood pressure. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, that's probably an adaptive mechanism to in you know, shock states to kind of preserve flow to the more vital organs.
Right.
You know, something like the skin would probably be the first one that would shut down, and maybe the gut after that. But there's probably a good reason for why that's happening.
So back to the Andromeda shock. So you mentioned the skin. So that's what they were looking at there. They were looking at capillary refill versus the lactate. And so it seemed that, you know, the lactate was possibly worse. You know, the data may not have, data certainly seemed to tend towards that, even though it wasn't designed for that specific question. But they did, you know, as Rory was discussing yesterday, target an immense clinical benefit to look for significance. So what do you think about the whole little trial? What can we take out of it?
What I took out of it, really, you know, it's about looking at the whole patient and kind of individualizing what's going on. I mean, you know, I can do all kinds of things with you know, dialing in, you know, the cardiac output and the SVR and stuff with you know, various, you know, vasopressors or ionodilators or whatever. But if my patient is like modeled and all that, there's still something wrong. You know, you got to put your hands on the patient and kind of look at things, you know. So I'm not going to, you know, be getting like two Q2 hour lactates, but I'm going to get one and then I'm going to recheck it maybe once. But not to use that as a mechanism for me to do something about it necessarily, but to make me think. And, you know, I personally, when I see the numbers that they came up with, I mean, there's something there. I mean, it's, you look at the Kaplan-Meier little graph and it's clear that there really is a difference. It just didn't get powered enough to show that the lactate was inferior to the perfusion, you know, checks, the capillary perfusion. So I don't think it's unfortunately going to change a lot of what people do, but I think it should.
Yeah, I agree. I think it'll at least allow people who have not been, you know, adhering to this lactate monosynaptic reflex to be validated and to sort of maybe not be persecuted for not doing that, and refocusing on the patient. I think that's a really good idea. And I find it interesting. I think we're going to almost go, it'd be curious to see, because a lot of the sepsis data, you know, the changes in mortality, you know, the sort of miraculous things that have been apparently done with, you know, sepsis saving, you know, surviving sepsis guidelines and all that. When you change your criteria all the time, it's hard to get a true, you know, a true feeling of what the real mortality for, say, severe sepsis is, you know? And I think I'd be curious to go back. I'd love to, you know, sort of time travel back to the 80s and find some of the, you know, the people who'd just been playing with, you know, SWANs and critical care for quite a while, you know, and didn't have to adhere to the feeling of following big trials, and see what they did, you know, how mm-hmm. much fluid they gave and how they followed it up. And I think it would have been interesting to have, you know, the guys who essentially were doing what you're doing, probably just minus the POCUS, you know. And I think that if you take that body of knowledge and understanding and experience and mix it in with POCUS together, I think the SWAN plus POCUS is a great combination. I think the more multimodality we can get, then the more accurate a picture we can build. And then the next step is to really figure out what's the least damage we can do, you know, while keeping someone alive. And I think that's a big question.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can, you know, I think the approach now is analogous to, you know, winning a war by dropping a nuclear bomb. You know, it's like, yeah, you can kind of make things go your way with a preemptive strike, but you're going to have to deal with the fallout and everything that's going to come from years to come. And, you know, so we can, you know, gush fluids into people, make the blood pressure look great, but downstream there's going to be, you know, a whole bunch of problems with deresuscitating that patient and probably dings to mortality.
Yeah, I think that's a really good, I think that'll be the title of the post, the nuclear approach. I like that. All right, Corbin, thanks for taking the time today.
Yep, thanks a lot. And always really good to talk to you every time.
Yep, same here. And thanks for everyone for listening.